I only forgot one thing. It was a wilderness camp that I was doing. 25 campers, 7 staff, and we were going on a canoe trip. So all the meals were made, the lunches were packed, they were loaded, got all the campers ready, got breakfast done, all the campers loaded. We're talking junior hires, right? Everything done. I had the money bag, had made the reservations. Everything was ready to go. I only forgot one thing. My sunblock. I am as white as a sheet, and I sat in a canoe, an aluminum canoe, crisscross applesauce for 4 hours. And so as you looked at me, the insides of my legs were red, and the outsides were as white as the wind-driven snow. Now imagine trying to sleep in a tent that's warm without letting your legs touch. I only forgot one thing. What did I learn? Thorough preparation is necessary. It doesn't matter if you remember 99 things, if you forget that one thing that really matters. Have you learned that too? What do you wish you were better prepared for? A test in school, you remember? Wishing, oh man, that was the one test I wish I would have studied for. Or maybe it was an evaluation that you were going to. One of my children, who's very intelligent, thought that all the study she needed, I just gave that away, before taking her driver's test, was reading the manual from school to the license branch. She didn't pass her test. Maybe you would say, well, you know, I really wasn't prepared for marriage, or I wish I'd been better prepared for children, or I wish I'd be better prepared for retirement. There are so many things that we need to get prepared for, and this morning we're taking a look at being prepared for the end times, because from what I understand, it's going to last a long time. Not the end times, but what comes on the other end of that. So we need to be prepared for that. So before we get into that, sprechen Sie Deutsch. A few of you. What I said was, do you speak German? That's most of the German that I know. I know ein bisschen. But we're taking a look at a different language this morning. And so I want to give you the background to that language. A lot of what Jesus says about the end times is couched in marriage language. And so we need to understand the marriage language, what happened in marriage at that time. And it's very different than the way we do dating and marriage in our culture. So marriage would be initiated by the parents. And if you have a child that would be mid-teen, and a few years before they would be old enough to get married, you would find parents of somebody you want your child to marry, and you would make arrangements with them. Hey, I notice you have a nice daughter. My son, in a few years, will want to get married. Let's start talking. And so they would start making arrangements. And when they got old enough, they would come together and they would have a meeting. And at the meeting, they would sign an agreement in this marriage, here are the things that are going to happen. This is the way things are going to be done in this marriage, and you would have an agreement. And here is the bride price, and so that would all be negotiated. And when that was done, the groom would take a cup and pour some wine into that cup, and he would take a sip from it, and he would give that to the lady who was going to be his bride. And he would say, "This is a cup of a new covenant. Drink from it." And if she drank that wine, then that was sealing that covenant. They were now, once she drank the wine, they were now betrothed. That was an official designation. The only way to break that betrothal is with a public divorce. They weren't married, as we would call it. They were engaged. And you just can't text someone and say, "Hey, let's call this off." It was a big deal to break that. And so the groom would then say to the young lady who's going to be his wife, "I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place to you, I will come again and take you to be with me, that where I am, there you may be also." I don't know if you've ever heard that before. And so he would leave, and he would go with his father, and they would basically build an addition onto his house. And it said, "Well, let's build it over here." And so the next day, and get this guy is motivated, right? Because when the house is done, what happens? He gets married. And so they're working on the house, and they got it framed up. And "Dad, can we go get her now?" No. "There's a lot more work to be done." And so very often the son would say to the father, "Can we go get my bride?" And he said, "No, not yet. But one day, they get everything done on this new addition, and the father and the son are walking through, and they're inspecting this new addition to the house, and they say, "It's ready. Tomorrow, we're going to go get your bride." And so they go to the village where this young lady is. And when they get to the village, they blow the trumpet. And there's a trumpet blast that means a groom is here to pick up his bride. And every betrothed virgin in that village, their hearts are going boop, 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 boop. Because they think, "Is he coming? Is this my groom?" And they go to the house. And if they're ready at that time, those in the wedding party that are ready go. If you're not ready, you don't go. You're not included. And then they go and they have the wedding party, which lasts for, we don't know how to get married in our culture. Other cultures, weddings last for a week. You got to mark out some time on the calendar. I've never been to a week-long wedding. But I understand that happens. And so they would party and they would celebrate for those who are ready. That is how marriage was done at the time of Jesus. And so when we read what Jesus says about that, we need to know the background. So, Matthew 24, starting in verse 36. "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor who? The Son, but only the Father." That's marriage language. No one knows the timing of the return of Jesus. No one knows the timing of the return of Jesus. I did some research. no one means no one. There is, that's one word in the original language. It's a contraction made of two words. One of them means no, and the other one means one. It means no one. No one knows. Anyone who says they know the timing is wrong. You hear somebody, I don't care how famous, I don't care how many books he has written. Anyone who claims to say, I know the timing is wrong. Anyone who says they know the timing thinks they are not smarter than a fifth grader. They're smart, they think they're smarter than Jesus. I hope I haven't overmade that point. But we have so many people who say they know the timing. And Jesus himself said, no one will know. Can I be honest? I want to know the timing. Wouldn't that be great to know the timing? But we are told that we won't know. And we're told that for a reason. We are a part of a denomination called the Missionary Church. And when I was a new pastor, the way things were done is you went through, to become a pastor, you went through a licensing. And I had to fill out all this paperwork. And back then, we did it with a pen, and we had like four lines to write. And so we had to write neatly and page after page after page on what do you believe about this and what do you believe about that. And then you go in, and there's these pastors and other district officials that are in there, and they're asking you questions about what you believe. It's really intimidating. And I went through that process. And so I was licensed. And then after you've been in ministry for 3 years, you have another one. To be ordained, you have to go through another process. And I was told, now this one isn't doctrinal. They won't get into all the what do you believe stuff. It'll be like, how do you know you're called into ministry? What's been the fruit of your ministry? What's your philosophy of ministry? That kind of stuff. It won't be doctrinal. They lied. Somebody lied. And it got into doctrinal stuff. And I didn't have my answers in front of me. And I was asked by our district superintendent, a man I've known since I was 8 years old, and he scared me back then too. He asked me, the Christians who were martyred during the tribulation, when will they be resurrected? And when you panic, the fight or flight mode kicks in, and a chemical is released in the brain, and no synapses is possible. You literally cannot think, and that happened to me in that moment. And another pastor spoke up after a very long, awkward pause and said, at the revelation. Oh. And because I couldn't say, at the revelation, I had to read a big, thick book before I could be ordained. And at the time, that interview thing happened in Elkhart, and I lived in Jackson, Michigan. And that's a 2.5-hour drive. And on the drive back, I thought of the perfect response. Now, it was perfect from my perspective. as you will see. I probably would not be a pastor today had I shared that response with the group. But here's my response. Here's what I thought of on the way home. When will the Christians be resurrected that are martyred during the tribulation? I don't know. That's not my job. You know I'm a smart aleck, right? And I like that. I like, the more I thought about that, the more I thought, yeah, what's my job? What's our job? And that's what Jesus goes on to say. Jesus goes on to say what our job is. Let's continue reading in Matthew 24, verse 37. As it was in the days of Noah, so will be it in the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days of the flood, people were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came upon them and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, another left. Two women will be grinding at a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch, excuse me, and would not have let his house be broken into. So you must also be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. No one will expect the return of Jesus. It will come at a time when no one expects it. No one is going to be going, oh, I see this is happening. And I like to understand that the second coming of Jesus. I like to go back to the first coming of Jesus. Because no matter how many people studied the coming of the Messiah, no one noticed that it happened. God had to gather foreigners from another country to come in and make the people in Israel aware. And Jesus has made this point several times. One of them is in Luke chapter 12, starting in verse 35. Be dressed and ready, and keep your lamps burning, as though you were waiting for your master to return from the wedding feast. Then you will be ready to open the door and let him in the moment he arrives and knocks. The servants who are ready and waiting for his return will be rewarded. I tell you the truth, he will seat them, put on an apron, and serve them as they sit and eat. He may come in the middle of the night or just before dawn, but whenever he comes, he will reward his servants who are ready. So what do you do when you don't know when that will happen? Verse 39, understand this, if a homeowner knew exactly when a burglar was coming, he would not permit his house to be broken into. You also must be ready all the time, for the Son of Man will come when least expected. So always be ready. Always be ready. When do we get ready? When we have to. How many of you were ready to come here today at 3:30 this morning? I wasn't. Why? Because we didn't need to. We only get ready when we need to be ready. And that is one of the reasons we're not told when he's going to be coming back, because we would wait for them to be ready. We need to always be ready. Always be ready. So how do you do that? I want to give you an image to remember that. Live with the roof off and the walls down. Live with the roof off and the walls down. And you may say, well, Pastor, that sounds like a really rickety house. Here's what I mean. Live with the roof off. This is your relationship with God. Live with the roof off. That your relationship with God, there's no unconfessed sin. That you're in the Word, you have a vibrant relationship with God. There's not some hidden sin in your life that you need to confess. There's not stuff you're hiding. As Jeremy shared on the video this morning, there's not these little sins of cheating here and there, of dishonest gain. Things between you and God are good. Live with the roof off. So you can pray Psalm 19, The end of that. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight. I'm not hiding anything from you. May be in your sight. Oh Lord, my rock and my redeemer. Live with the roof off and then the walls down. That means that your relationships with other people are good. There's no tit-for-tat battles going on between you and others. There's no revenge-seeking. Are there people in your life that make you grit your teeth? Right? Are there people like that? Live with the walls down. When Diane knew she was dying, she didn't have to call anybody. She was living with the walls down. There wasn't anybody, oh, I got to get things right with her and I got to get things right with them. There wasn't any of that. She was living with the walls down. That's how we need to live. Live with the roof off in your relationship with God. Every time you look at the cross, think about it. Your relationship with God. Live with the roof off and the walls down. You're right here with God. And that your relationship with everybody else. Now, you may have people in your life that are mad at you, that don't like you, that think you're ugly and smell funny. Okay. But have you done everything you need to do to make things right? Paul says, as much as depends on you, live at peace with all men. Are you doing that? That's how we need to live. And it's not like, yeah, you know what? I did that, you know, 6 years ago. I went to a conference and did that. No, it's this daily commitment of daily living. Because I don't know if you know this, life happens. I think about that when you go on a vacation and you're driving for a while in the car or you're going on a long trip and all of a sudden something happens to your windshield. Not like all at once, but just like you get there and then you get to the gas station and you wash your windshield and you take off from the gas station. It's like, wow, everything looks better, doesn't it? And that's what you need to do. Regularly evaluate. Is the roof off? Are the walls down? And go through a cleansing process. The passage goes on in Matthew 24, verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom the master will put in charge of his servants in his household to give them the food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and in an hour that he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. No one should become unprepared for the return of Jesus. This is a person that started out well, and they started out living for the kingdom, but then gradually started living for the immediate. And then this thought entered their mind, I don't have to be prepared all the time. It's okay, I was prepared, and I can mess around for a while, and then when I know he's coming, I'll get prepared again. It'll be okay. I can do what I want for a while. There was a hawk that came down over this river and grabbed a fish and had this great feast waiting for him. And there was a big block of ice floating down the river. And so he landed on that block of ice with that fish and he began feasting on that fish going down the river. And in the distance, you can hear what was coming. There was a waterfall. And that hawk, I assume, knew the waterfall was coming. But he kept feasting, and kept feasting, and kept feasting. He was occupied in what he was occupied in. And he heard the waterfall coming, and at the last minute went to fly. But he'd been on that ice for so long, his feet were frozen to that block of ice. And he went down and died in the waterfall. That is so easy. That's so, such a subtle shift. We're going this direction, and then we just oh, it worked so slightly. It'll be okay. And we listen to that voice. And we veer ever so slightly. Jesus says in Matthew 25, verse 1, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 bridesmaids who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 of them were wise. The 5 who were foolish didn't take enough olive oil for their lamps. The other 5 were wise enough to take along extra oil. When the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, they were roused by the shout, "Look, the bridegroom is coming. Come out and meet him." All the bridesmaids got up and prepared their lamps. Then the 5 foolish ones asked the others, "Please give us some of the oil because our lamps are going out." But the others replied, "We don't have enough for all of us. Go to the shop and buy some for yourself." But while they were gone, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went to be with him to the marriage feast, and the door was locked. Later, when the other 5 bridesmaids returned, they stood outside calling, "Lord, Lord, open the door for us." But he called back, "Believe me, I don't know you. So you too must keep watch, for you don't know the day or the hour of my return." These are warnings for us to be ready. But how do we do that? 2 Peter Chapter 3, Peter is talking about the coming of the day of the Lord. Notice what he writes. "Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire, and the elements will melt in the heat. But in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells." So let's break that down and apply that to our lives. He said, live holy and godly lives. We need to live with focus. Holiness means set apart. We see ourselves as set apart or holy. Hebrews 12:1 says, throw off everything that hinders. It's not that these things are sin, it's just there's stuff that gets us distracted. Let's say you're at your favorite steak restaurant and you just ordered a 16-ounce T-bone steak. Right? And you're waiting for that. And they bring in a bunch of stale chips that you can feed on. Do you eat the chips? Do you fill up on the chips? No, you don't fill up on the stupid chips because you got steak coming. You're saying, no, I'm waiting for the good stuff, right? That's what it means to be holy. No, I'm not going to get involved in that. It might be okay, but I want the good stuff. That's holy living. That's focused living. Peter said, since everything is going to be destroyed, we ought to be holy, godly lives. He says, as you look forward to the day of God, we need to live with resilience. Jesus, it says in Hebrews 12:2, who for the joy set before him endured the cross. He endured incredible torture because of what he was looking forward to. And we can be resilient by doing the same thing, focusing on our future in heaven. If you're in the frozen tundra, like in Alaska or Antarctica or somewhere bitter cold, if you're almost to the point of freezing to death, but you can see a fire in the distance, you will not freeze to death. That's enough hope to get you there, and that's what that's like. Peter says, as you look forward to the day, don't lose sight of that day. Look forward to that day. And then he says, as you speed its coming. Speed its coming. We can speed the coming of the day of God? We can speed that? Yeah, how? Live with purpose. Live with purpose. What's our purpose for being here? What's our purpose for gathering together as a body of believers? What's our purpose? Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Teach these new disciples to obey all the commands I've given you. And be sure of this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. What's our purpose to be here? Make disciples. Make disciples. Make little people. Make people that follow Jesus and obey Jesus. That's our purpose for being here. Now, from last week, do you remember Matthew 24, 14? Remember? Here, I'll remind you. And the good news of the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world so that all the nations will hear it. And then the end will come. Telling other people about Jesus is how we see the coming. If we could work it out so that everybody, every ethnic language would have the gospel in their language, then it's ready for the Lord to come back. That's why these things are so important. Help cards. Hear God's leading. Engage someone in a conversation. I'm guessing, and I don't know this for sure, I don't know your life that well, I'm guessing you have multiple conversations in a day. And sometimes when you're having a conversation, God clears his throat. I don't know if you know what that's like. And so listen to them and point them to Jesus. When you're in that conversation, God reminds me, oh, say this, or ask him about me. Do that on a regular basis. That's how we see the coming of Jesus. Live with purpose. Have a help conversation. And then when you have a conversation, and maybe all you know is his name's, you know, is Gary. You write down Gary on the back and put this card in your pocket every day you do that, you go, Gary, yeah, Lord, I gave Gary that challenge. Work on Gary's heart. And you pray for Gary every day and see what God does in that. A couple weeks ago, Hurricane Milton hit Florida. And I have a cousin who lives in Florida. Anita and I went to high school together, graduated together, and she lives in Sarasota, Florida. And so I thought, the eye was heading right at Sarasota. And so I messaged her and I said, you guys okay? I love what she wrote back. Listen to this. We're not in an evacuation zone, and our house is up to the latest hurricane codes. So we're prepared to ride out the storm here, We have a good generator, and John just bought a 240-gallon gas tank that we filled last Friday for the first time. I was able to get all the groceries we need and have been cooking and baking yesterday and today. Now, let me tell you something about Anita. Anita and John ran a restaurant in Sarasota, Florida for 20, 30 years or more. They know how to cook. They're Mennonite. They know how to cook. Yesterday and today, so all we'll need to run is the microwave. We have a house full, they have six kids, and most of their kids and grandkids were living with them. They all came to their house during the hurricane. So we'll have a house full, and we'll make this as fun as possible for the little ones. I read that, and I was like, Sandy, you want to go to Sarasota? Didn't that sound fun? They're going to have a blast. That's what it's like when you're prepared. The end times will be challenging and difficult, and you'll be tested. But everything they needed to do, they had done. They made preparations to their house, the generator, the fuel, the cookies. I'm sure there were pies. Ooh. Right? That's my hope. That's my prayer for all of you. That we would all be that prepared. So it'll come, it'll be challenging, and we'll go, yeah, we're ready. We're ready. We're prepared. That's our purpose. Would you stand with me? Heads bowed, eyes closed. I want to talk to you about your roof. Is the roof off? Is there anything in your life that you need to confess to the Lord? Do it now. Just say, God, please forgive this. For some of you this morning, you have to admit, I haven't been living completely for you. And this morning, I'm challenging you to say to the Lord, Lord, I am completely yours. I recommit my life to you this morning. I want your will to be done in my life. I am yours. Say that to him right now. Some of you this morning, you're living for the Lord, but your permissions have terminated. You're not giving God permission to do everything he wants in your life. You have a line in the sand, and you say, God, I will obey you this far and no farther. And this morning, God is asking you to erase that line and just simply, God, whatever you want to do in my life, I give you permission to do anything you want with my life. You tell him that right now. And now that the roof's off, we need to get the walls down. Who do you need to forgive? Forgive them right now. Just say, God, I forgive this person. And you'll probably have to forgive them this afternoon at 3 o'clock and tomorrow and keep doing it. It's a process, but forgive them. Who do you need to talk to? Who do you need to say, I'm sorry, I was online? Commit right now to the Lord that you're going to talk to Him. Father, that's all you need. All you need is a group of people with the roof off and the walls down, and you will begin to do incredible things through us. Because it's you at work. Thank you. Thank you for what you're going to do in us. Thank you for what you're doing in us. And then when we give you permission by taking the roof off, then you'll begin to do amazing things through us. Thank you. Thank you. In Jesus' name. Amen.